Good morning, Your Honor. Matthew Pruitt for the appellant. May it please the court. At the heart of this, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for my response for reply at the end. At the heart of this appeal is the court's conflating of injunctive orders and the failure of service upon Dean Properties of any notice of any injunction that applied in any way to Dean Properties. To understand why the court's order enforcing the SEC's asset freeze is wholly inappropriate and robs my client of due process, the court first needs to understand the timeline. First, Dean Properties filed its complaint in January 14, 2016. That was 4 months prior to the SEC filing its complaint and receiving the temporary restraining order. That temporary restraining order, there was a letter sent to my client that generally notified my client that a temporary restraining order was obtained, but it didn't attach the temporary restraining order and didn't notify my client that it applied to them in any way. Additionally, when my client obtained its judgment, the temporary restraining order was not in place. Rather, it had been replaced by a preliminary injunction on June 10th, 2016. And so when we obtained a judgment on June 21st, 2016, no one had notified my client about a preliminary injunction, rather just the temporary restraining order, which had differing terms from the preliminary injunction.
So could I just interrupt? Because I think what you're getting at is that your client didn't know that this consent judgment would be improper. But wasn't the SEC's point and the district court's point that David Kaplan knew and he couldn't enter the consent?
Well, that I think was part of their point. First of all, I think that's an impermissible collateral attack on another court's judgment. I don't think that the SEC or the court provides any support for why a collateral attack on that judgment would be appropriate in this case. But beyond that, the preliminary injunction did not prohibit the Kaplans from entering into a settlement and obtaining permission to a consent judgment.
Well, didn't it prevent them from incurring a debt, and wasn't the consent judgment essentially a debt at that point?
I don't think so. I think the consent judgment is just a manifestation that Dean Properties can collect on a debt that's pre-existing. So consenting to judgment is just a settlement saying, okay, we acknowledge that this debt exists, and the court is allowing Dean Properties now to enforce that judgment.
It seems like there's a lot sort of embedded in that, though, because the point of the lawsuit was that there had been some wrongdoing, and I'm not sure he would have. I mean, they did enter this consent judgment, but that seems like it agreed with the premise that there was the debt, which probably before that there wasn't agreement that there was a debt.
Well, I think there has to be. I mean, Dean Properties provided money to this party, and they filed their complaint, 4 months before the SEC filed its complaint. The SEC was fully aware that Dean Properties had this complaint out. They actually consulted with Dean Properties about their own complaint. At no time did they ever come to Dean Properties and say that, you need to stay your case or you need to stop this. If the court really intended to stop all these other claims from private investors, it should have included that in its injunction, but it didn't. An injunction needs to be specific in order to be upheld under due process and under Rule 65.
But why shouldn't we just read the injunction as running against David? And so that would then affect Dean, but it wasn't really against Dean.
Well, I mean, it can run against David, but again, the injunction prohibited a debt against property, and a judgment is not a debt against property. A judgment is just piece of paper that says, okay, you can use whatever tools to execute and collect on this debt. But the Kaplans didn't in any way apply that debt to a property. Rather, the Dean Properties, who had no notice of the injunction, later went and recorded that debt against a property. But that was not in concert with the Kaplans.
So I thought the argument in your reply brief about the final judgments superseding the asset freeze was quite interesting, but I don't remember seeing it in your opening brief or really prior to your reply brief. And usually we don't allow parties to raise a new argument in their reply brief. Could you speak to whether it appears any time before your reply brief?
I do believe we mentioned that. The preliminary injunction. Let's see.
It was in your reply brief at page 11 and 12.
And I know, Your Honor, we mentioned that. I'm trying to look through the papers to see where we mentioned it, but it may not have been as in detail covered. But certainly it's important for the court to take note of that was not in place, that the judgment. Oh, and I mean, I think it's covered actually.
You know, when you come back on rebuttal,
I'd
like to move you to a different point if I could. Let's assume that we agreed with you that the district court's first rationale for its order was not valid. That, in other words, forget about the notice issue, forget about the supposed invalidity of the judgment your client obtained. I thought the district court also had a second rationale, which related more toward kind of the priority of the respective claims to the property that's out there. And the court exercised, I thought, its equitable powers to essentially prevent you from jumping the line and getting a more favorable treatment than your fellow defrauded investors. Maybe you can speak to why the district court was wrong on that front.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that we didn't jump a line at all. I mean, we had filed before the SEC filed. We obtained a judgment. The statutes allow for individual investors to bring private causes of action. That was completely appropriate for us to do. We recorded first on the property. You know, if the SEC wanted to, and the SEC has a lot of decision on how to spread out the funds that they disperse, you know, if they wanted to take our recovery in an account, I assume that's something that they would do. But for the court to say that an individual investor can't collect on its judgment, I think that flies in the face of what Congress intended.
Well, it's sort of like the rationale that pertains in the bankruptcy context. We don't want individual creditors basically moving to dismember the debtor in a way that's going to allow them to reap greater than their pro rata share of what they should be entitled to. And it seems to me that rationale applies quite forcefully here.
This isn't bankruptcy. There's no guarantee that the SEC would even pursue an action. The SEC isn't required to disperse funds to the individual investors. And so if an individual investor wants to recover, they're either at the mercy of the SEC wanting to pursue things and then actually dispersing after pursuing it, or they have to make the choice to spend considerable assets of their own to recover what they've lost. And I think that, you know, we shouldn't discourage that. We should encourage them being able to recover that if they're going to spend considerable assets themselves. especially when my client provided a lot of information to the SEC supporting all the claims that the SEC made.
Right, but the SEC's action is brought basically on behalf of you and all the other, not you, but your client and all the other defrauded investors. I read the final judgment as requiring the SEC to basically collect, you know, to gather all of the available assets and to form a fund to distribute. To, again, I assume if there's not going to be recovery 100 cents on the dollar on some pro rata basis, and you're jumping in to try to get more favored treatment strikes me as something that the district court had the power under its equitable powers to stop.
I don't believe so. I think that was an unconstitutional taking by, you know, anytime a court takes private property rights, you know, we had private property rights to the judgment and to the and to the judgment lien. And anytime that happens, it's an unconstitutional taking if done without compensation.
What's your best case authority for that proposition, which I find highly, highly dubious?
Ileto versus Glock, final judgments of causes of action are vested property rights.
Cite a case in which there was a fight over the priority of liens, in which a court exercising its equitable powers favored one lien over the other, and it was ruled to be a taking of property for, you know, some kind of public use. That just doesn't strike me as a viable constitutional argument at all. But what's your best authority for that proposition?
Well, Stop the Beach, Beach Renourishment versus Florida Department of Environmental Protection. So
that's about real property, though, isn't it? That case, it's like about sand and water.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. And you know, here we have real property interests as well with our judgment lien.
How do you deal with the cases that the SEC relies on? It's in particular Wanky or Wank. And I think is the other one Hickey. I can't remember the second case.
Yeah. Wanky dealt with a stay on the state court. And also a receivership. This case didn't involve a receivership. Rather, it's an in personam injunction that has to be served on people to be enforceable. The court could have gone the route of establishing a receivership over this property, and that would be an in rem receivership, but it didn't. And so the injunction wasn't over the property itself, but was just over the persons that were going to act on the property. And so they had to have proper notice for the injunction to be effective.
Yeah, but I'm asking you, sorry, go ahead, Judge Moore.
I was just going to ask why the receivership matters. I mean, that is a factual distinction from Wanky, but I thought our rationale there was that the district court has inherent equitable authority to, when it's hearing this kind of case, to ensure that there's going to be some property left so that there can be effective relief at the end of the case.
Sure.
And that rationale applies equally here, it would seem.
It has equitable authority, but not beyond the bounds of due process and the takings clause. And so if my client hasn't been properly noticed about the injunction, then that's not due process.
Doesn't this get back to the point that the injunction can run against David? I still don't really understand why the court can't equitably protect the assets so that all of the defrauded investors can recover by having an injunction against the Kaplans.
Well, the court can enjoin the Kaplans' actions, but it didn't enjoin our actions. It can only enjoin the actions of the Kaplans and those who are an active concert.
But if the Kaplans hadn't agreed to the consent judgment, you wouldn't have it, right?
That's true. But the consent judgment was not against property. It wasn't a debt against property, which is what the preliminary injunction sought to prohibit. And that debt against property, it later became one, but but not by the hand of the captains.
Mr. Pruitt, can I ask you, are you able to see the clock?
I am not, Your Honor.
Okay, because I can't either. I was just scared.
Seems like it went away, which I wonder.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, you should continue. I'm just, I know.
Well, if Your Honors, you know, don't have any other questions, I'll save what may be a few minutes.
This is the courtroom in Pasadena. Let me just see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Michelle Friedland. Hi, are you guys disconnected?
Very good. So Mr. Capehart, you are up, and it looks like we've got 15 minutes on the clock for you. So whenever you're ready, please proceed.
Great. Thank you, Judge Blackford, and may it please the court. Dean Properties' arguments concerning the various orders that the district court entered before judgment in this case are a collective distraction on several levels. Only two orders matter for purposes of this appeal. The order invalidating the judgment lien that Dean Properties acquired in violation of the asset freeze, and the order enjoining Dean Properties from executing on assets that were subject to that asset freeze. Dean Properties has waived any challenge with respect to the injunction order, and its Fifth Amendment challenges to the order invalidating its lien are meritless on the face of the record. With respect to its due process challenge, Dean Properties doesn't meaningfully dispute the district court's finding that it received actual notice of the asset freeze on multiple occasions before and after it acquired its judgment lien. It contends only and without any supporting authority that that notice wasn't actual enough, even though in April of 2018, it stipulated as to the asset freeze's existence and scope. Second, invalidating Dean Properties' judgment lien did not violate the takings clause. Even assuming that a nonspecific judgment lien qualified as a constitutionally protectable property interest, a position for which, again, Dean Properties points to no supporting authority, the lien was acquired in violation of the district court's lawful orders, and in any event, at best, could have applied only to real property, it could have applied to real property in the county in which Dean Properties' judgment debtors owned no real property.
Let me stop you there, just to push back on one point you made. Let's say that we disagreed with your position that the entry of the judgment itself in the Eastern District of Virginia was somehow a void or, you know, a null act because it conflicted in some way with the asset freeze order. Because I don't really buy that, to be honest. I think the entry of the judgment itself didn't inflict any harm on the SEC's ability to openly collect on this judgment. And in fact, the judgment would be valid presumably long after the SEC is done collecting whatever, you know, assets it can gather now. What the problematic point, as you mentioned, is the entry of the lien, and that's the action that I think the district court was rightly focused on. Maybe respond to your opponent's argument that the invalidation of that lien constituted a taking of Dean Properties' property interest.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I want to clarify first, as you point out, the district court did not attack the Virginia judgment in this case. In fact, it said nothing about the Virginia judgment. And my point, and I apologize for not being clear, but my point was that the lien itself was acquired in violation of the asset freeze. There's no question, I think.
The reason I jumped in is that I don't think that's correct. The asset freeze did not bind Dean Properties. Dean Properties wasn't subject to any kind of an injunctive order forbidding it to take steps to, you know, acquire a lien. So what the district court said is that somehow Mr. Kaplan had done something wrong in the Eastern District of Virginia by agreeing to entry of the judgment. And that's the step in the analysis that I'm questioning. When you shift forward to when Dean Properties, perfectly free to do whatever it wants, not bound by any asset freeze order, when it acquired the lien, that didn't violate any order that the district court had entered against Dean Properties. It was just acting on its own. And at that point, the Kaplans were totally out of the picture.
I think that's right, Your Honor. But I think, again, the attempted enforcement of that lien, particularly given that Dean Properties knew about the asset freeze, did run afoul of the district court's orders and did justify the district court acting under its inherent equitable authority to safeguard both its equitable processes and the equitable relief that at that court, that at that point, the court had ordered for the benefit of all of Mr. Kaplan's victims.
Counsel, may I ask, the district court used the phrase set aside the lien. What do you think it means to set aside the lien as opposed to simply enjoining execution of the on lien?
I believe what it's saying. I mean, I think not to be too flip, but I think that it means what it says. I mean, I think the lien itself is no longer capable of enforcement. And I take your point, however, that it may seem duplicative given the separate injunction order. But I think the court's point was to, if nothing else, clear title or to establish a priority system so that the SEC's pre-existing enforcement efforts could proceed unencumbered by any device that deemed properties might try to throw up to interfere with those efforts again.
But is it your understanding that setting aside then of it doesn't seem like it should be a permanent block on the lien, but is that what you're saying? You think it is a permanent block?
I'm not sure whether it would qualify as a permanent block because, of course, deemed properties is always free to move to modify or seek revision of the district court's order, and the district court would then evaluate whether that was appropriate under the circumstances. I think the court's point for present purposes was simply to make way for the FEC's equitable enforcement efforts to continue.
So how long will that take? I mean, should there be a time limit on this? Like the district court should have said 2 years or something?
We're not sure how long it would take, Your Honor. And I think, right now we don't know principally because we have been litigating whether the Wheat Commission can even continue with its collection efforts. It's unclear how long the general collections process takes, but 2 points. I mean, again, as I said, Dean Properties is always free to move to modify the district court's order. But also the asset freeze only applies to property that was considered an asset of the Kaplan's at the time of its imposition. Nothing prohibits deemed properties from attempting to levy on assets or their property that is not subject to that order. I think that's it.
Could you speak to this argument in the reply brief that the final judgments actually superseded the asset freeze, and it doesn't seem like this property is listed in the final judgments. So I'm a little bit unclear what your response will be to that.
Sure. Well, I think that my first point is that argument has been waived. It was not raised in front of the district court, and it was raised for the first time in this court in the reply brief. But my second point, I think, assuming that a challenge has been preserved, is that it doesn't really make a difference. It doesn't affect whether the asset freeze survives the final judgment or not, has no bearing on whether the district court rightly invalidated the lien, whether with respect to the court's injunction order either. It has nothing to do with deemed properties' due process clause challenge. It is perhaps maybe relevant to their takings clause challenge, although again, the only interest that Dean Properties has ever been able to assert in the Kaplan's asset arose from a clear violation of the district court's orders. That taint does not go away. And even if it could be washed clean, it wouldn't change the fact that interest, to the extent it existed, only applied to real property in a county where Dean Properties judgment debtors owned no real property. So whether the asset freeze survived the judgment or not makes no difference for purposes of the orders under review. If I could, I'd like to turn briefly to Judge Miller's and Judge Watford's comments concerning the scope of district court's equitable authority here. My colleague's reading of the Winkie case as somehow cabining district court's inherent equitable powers situations in which a receiver has been appointed can't be squared with the Winkie decision itself. So, for example, at page 1369 of the opinion, the court notes that, quote, the power of a district court to impose a receivership or to grant other forms of ancillary relief derives from the inherent power of a court of equity to fashion effective relief. And likewise, at page 1371, the court noted again that, quote, the Supreme Court has repeatedly emphasized the broad equitable powers of a federal court to shape equitable remedies to the necessities of particular cases, especially, as in this case, where a federal agency seeks enforcement in the public interest. If the Supreme Court's or this court's precedent stood for the proposition that a court's inherent power was bound up in the appointment of a receiver, neither would have spoken about the scope of that power in such sweeping terms. And more to the point, this court certainly wouldn't have, in later cases, affirmed Winkie's articulation of court's inherent powers where the nature of the equitable relief imposed had nothing to do with the receivership. So, for example, in Hickey, this court relied on Winkie to affirm the imposition of an asset freeze against the defendant's non-party affiliate, noted at page 1131 that the asset freeze was authorized, quote, by the district court's broad equitable powers drawn from a tradition of allowing courts to reach third parties in order to effect orders in securities fraud enforcement actions. And in fact, even outside of the securities context, for in FTC, the Americans for Financial Reform, for example, the court again looks to Winkie and other similar authorities to in order to protect its equitable power and to give effect to its judgments. Now, the only qualifications on that power are that it be exercised for a protective purpose, that is to protect court's equitable processes or equitable relief that's been imposed, and that the party to be bound have notice. Now, both happened here. The district court invalidated the lien because, first, David Kaplan had squarely violated the asset freeze in consenting to the Virginia judgment. And two, Kaplan and Dean Properties had frustrated the purpose of the asset freeze. And three, their collective misconduct had compromised the commission's effective enforcement of the federal securities laws. And even if they had preserved a challenge to the injunction order, Dean Properties repeatedly attempted to interfere with the district court's and the commission's efforts to to effectuate the final judgments in this case. And in those circumstances, the district court rightly concluded that it should act to preserve the status quo and to ensure the integrity of its proceedings. Now, I understand my colleague's point that Dean Properties did not have notice of the asset freeze, did not have sufficient notice, but that simply cannot be squared with the record. As the commission explained in its brief, Dean Properties received because it actively participated in that litigation.
Can I ask why, under your argument regarding the district court's inherent equitable powers, why does it matter whether Dean had notice of the asset freeze or not?
Because it's clear from cases like Winkie that the courts who are going to exercise their inherent power against a third party, someone who may not fall within, say, the scope of a traditional Rule 65 injunction, should at least have notice of what the district court's doing. I think that's reasonable, and it's also certainly what happened in this case.
Well, but it seems that under your view of what the district court had the authority to do here, even if Dean Properties first learned of, the existence of the SEC's action in, I can't remember what month and year it was, sometime in 2019 when it tried to perfect this lien, I assume the SEC would still take the position that that lien could not take priority over the SEC's collection efforts. Is that right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay, so it just seems like the notice part that you spent a little time talking about is irrelevant then. At least...
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, you cut out. Would you mind repeating that last bit?
It seemed like
I understand, Your Honor.
Can you respond to your opponent's assertion that actually the SEC is not really trying to do anything to collect this money to pay out to defrauded investors, and that in fact you're under no obligation to do that?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm happy to. I point the court first to the judgment in this case, which specifically ordered the commission to retain any funds collected for possible inclusion in a fair fund to be distributed to Mr. Kaplan's victims. And I think apart from any general authority as the primary regulator of the national securities law, or excuse me, of the national securities markets to act on behalf of investors. The district court's order makes clear that that is what the commission is supposed to do in this case.
And what is the status of the collection effort?
From my understanding, Your Honor, those efforts are stayed pending this appeal.
All of them?
At least with respect to David Kaplan and Mrs. Kaplan, yes.
Wait, but aren't they the only people that now I'm very confused. Shouldn't there be lots of different properties and there's only one property at issue in this case? I mean, this isn't their only asset, is it?
We believe this is the only asset capable of satisfying Mrs. Kaplan's disgorgement obligation. I am not sure about the extent of Mr. Kaplan's or Sosie's assets. I do not have that information in front of me. I apologize.
Because this seems quite concerning. I mean, the reason for this freeze is so the SEC can collect enough property to distribute to the victims, but it shouldn't go on forever. I mean, if they can get enough property, then Dean Properties should be able to collect on this lien, I think. So I'm concerned by your answer that you don't seem to know or that nothing's happening. I don't really understand that.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, as I said, the only asset really at issue in this appeal is Lisa Kaplan's house. And I think the commission has not tried to move on collection of that house because it is specifically tied up in this.
I understand that, but have they tried to collect enough money in other ways to give to the victims?
I do not have the information on the current status of their collection efforts in front of me. It's my understanding that collection has been stayed pending the outcome of this case.
I just don't understand why that would be true as to any other property that the Kaplans might have or any bank accounts. I mean, the final judgment listed a bunch of bank accounts and investment accounts. I don't understand why any of the collection of those things would be affected by this one house.
I understand, Your Honor, and I'm sorry. I do not have more information concerning the current status of collections in front of me. I'm happy to submit a letter with more up-to-date information if the court so desires.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Capehart. Let's put, I don't know if we know how much, I know it's not 5 minutes and 5:53. Let's put 3 minutes on the clock for Mr. Pruitt for rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Wanky case was mentioned. I wanted to respond on that. I think Wanky is pretty irrelevant actually to this matter because we're not disputing the court's equitable authority to grant the asset freeze. We're just saying it didn't apply to Dean Properties or to their judgment. And so, you know, we're discussing matters of notice and what the injunction actually said, which did not apply to Dean Properties or their judgment. If we read the actual text of the injunction, the preliminary injunction, it talks about transferring, selling, encumbering, and doing this on any funds, assets, or property. A judgment itself is not any of these actions on the property or assets of the Kaplans. Further, I did want to let the court know I did find the citation regarding the final injunction on January 8, 2018, and that is on page 15 of our brief. It's not in extreme detail, but we do make the argument that the injunction as presently constituted is the January 8, 2018 injunction. And so when the one problem we come to with the court's order is that she's...
But I don't see anything about superseding the asset freeze. I mean, the thing that I thought was interesting about your argument was that maybe the asset freeze was actually no longer in place by the time you got the lien. But that doesn't seem to be on page 15.
That's just the truth of it. I mean, if we're saying that the injunction as presently constituted is the one from January 8, 2018, then that means that it's superseded because any time you have a preliminary injunction and it gets to final judgment, it's no longer in effect. It's assumed by that final injunction. And that final injunction did not include an asset freeze. And so if the court's saying, if the court's injunction here, if their order is saying that we can't enforce anything that is restricted by the asset freeze, it's really meaningless because there is no asset freeze still in place that would prohibit us from executing on the property. And I also wanted to point out that, you know, if they're arguing that the enforcement of the lien was the violation, that all happened after the permanent injunction was in place and when the asset freeze was no longer in place. So it couldn't be a violation of the asset freeze.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Appreciate the argument. The case just argued is submitted.